Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast, powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, joining you from our sumptuously padded studio in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined, as always, from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, John Kennedy.
Hello, George.
And by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor, Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And a lot of referees would probably step in right there and stop the fight, but not us. We're going to go for a full podcast pummeling beatdown because we have a special guest with us here in studio in West Palm Beach. Joining us for the second time, Palm Beach Post staff writer Lulu Ramadan.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, you know, it's no exaggeration to say that this has been a historic week in Florida politics. Ron DeSantis sworn in as Florida's 46th governor, and John Kennedy's going to fill us in on that. Former Governor Rick Scott, a few hours later, became the new United States Senator in Washington for Florida. And more than a million people who completed sentences for felonies became eligible to vote. And that was just on Tuesday. On Wednesday, DeSantis began reshaping Florida's Supreme Court by appointing Barbara Lagoa. She is a Cuban-American appellate judge from Miami, a conservative, and he's got two more appointments to come. And the week's not over yet. We're recording this on Thursday, January 10th, day three of the DeSantis administration. I'm sure there's more news that'll be coming up in the days ahead. And also on the podcast, because it's never too early to talk about the 2020 presidential race, we'll hear some audio from my exclusive interview with Palm Beach County resident Frank Biden. He's the younger brother of Joe Biden. And we're going to hear him talk about whether the former VP will run for president. And we'll also hear Frank Biden's unvarnished take on Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. But first, I believe I hear some kind of royalty-free funky music playing. You hear that, Lulu?
I do.
Now, you're not a regular on the podcast, but I think you know what that means. What does that music mean?
Well, I'm a regular listener, so I do know that that means that it's time for the Pick a Number segment.
That's right. That's the recurring segment on the podcast where each of us puts forward a number, and then we explain what that number means in Florida politics. Lulu, do you have a number for us this week?
I do. I'm excited to join in. So my number this week is 36.5.
Precision number there by Lulu Ramadan, our special guest. Zach Anderson, do you have a number for us?
Yeah, George, I'm going with an 84 this week.
84 from Zach Anderson over in Sarasota. And John Kennedy in Tallahassee, what's your number this week?
George, like Lulu, I'm getting into the decimal places. I have an 18.4.
18.4. A lot of decimals floating around this week. And my number, George Bennett, that's me, my number is going to be 432, so I'm the curve buster this week. And as always, we do encourage listeners to take notes as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery. And so just to review, Lulu Ramadan, special guest, 36.5 is her number. Zach Anderson with an 84. John Kennedy with an 18.4. And George Bennett, that's me. My number is 432. You want to hang on to those numbers and at the end of the podcast, find out what those numbers mean in Florida politics. But let's get to our loaded lineup today. I always say we have a loaded lineup, but this week I really mean it. Ron DeSantis inaugurated this week as Florida's 46th governor. John Kennedy, reporting legend from Tallahassee. You were there. You've been to a lot of inaugurations. Give us your thoughts, takeaways from Ron DeSantis' inauguration in Tallahassee.
Well, George, you know, the thing that kind of sums things up is always the inaugural address for a governor, you know, when he gets to sort of lay out some of his future vision and policies and reflect on everything that got him there. And, you know, every inaugural address, it seems that it reaches for some lofty goals, maybe cites a couple of points in history where people have overcome challenges. And then it serves up some red meat for the voting base that got the candidate elected and is there cheering him on or him or her on. DeSantis went to that formula and all told, he seemed to use it pretty effectively. You know, inaugural have their symbolism and their phrases that are memorable, some more than others. Recall, you know, some of the inaugurals I've seen in the past. You had Jeb Bush in his second inaugural address. He drew attention by mentioning how he looked and he, quote, looked forward to the day when these buildings of government are empty, which a lot of people took as, you know, he was committed to continuing what has been a pretty seismic downsizing of state government in Florida. Rick Scott, in his first inaugural address, talked about how government can only give to us what it has previously taken from us. So there you go. You know, that's kind of the Republican mantra on the view of government, I guess, that those two guys echoes. DeSantis, you know, while he's a conservative Republican, just like these other two, he seemed maybe to take a slightly different tack. Bush and Scott had never served in elected office, while DeSantis, of course, was coming to Tallahassee after three terms in Congress. So he bruised government a little bit, saying it's not its role to run our lives for us. He quoted Lincoln saying it provides an open field and fair chance for one's industry, enterprise, and intelligence. So he's kind of given government a little bit of a purpose there. So, you know, after the inaugural, you saw a little bit more of it where, you know, he hosted a lunch for legislative leaders in which he talked about his days in Congress and how so much of being a congressman was really just following a leader. He said he wanted a strong and active state legislature. So that's kind of a unique stance for him.
As we've discussed on the podcast a lot, you know, Florida's had Republican governors and Republican legislatures for the last 20 years, and yet there have been a lot of conflicts between the executive and legislative branches. So you think there's a sign that things could be different with Governor DeSantis?
He sounds like he's trying to, you know, work with them as opposed to dictate to them. So that's kind of a, you know, unusual position for first time governor coming in. But, you know, DeSantis also presents kind of a new generational image. He took the oath of office with his wife, 9-month-old son Mason, in her arms, and the couple baptized Mason at the governor's mansion in between events on Tuesday. So DeSantis, you know, at 40 years old, he's 26 years younger than Rick Scott, who preceded him, and, you know, had a much lower role in the inaugural this time. That torches past moment, you know, seemed to be something that DeSantis knew he could highlight. And, you know, then he had a lot to say about addressing Florida's beleaguered economy, the beleaguered environment is the hardest thing that he's dealing with right now, something that could have bipartisan support if he does it right, trying to do some fixes there, while he also managed to play to the Republican crowd by, you know, he touts school choice, low taxes, bashing the courts, and condemning illegal immigration. Then also interestingly, you know, for a guy who maybe owes a lot to Donald Trump, who endorsed him early on in what looked like a long shot campaign against a Republican frontrunner, Adam Putnam, the new governor didn't find a spot in his 20-minute inaugural address to mention the president at all, not once. So instead, he talked about trying to bring an end to political tribalism, something that, you know, a lot of people think that Trump is the guy who's helping foster.
That is interesting because DeSantis has in the past highlighted, you know, how he's going to be in a position to work well with the administration and the federal government. But you're right. He did not bring that up in his inaugural address. You know, one thing that jumped out at me, and you mentioned the environment, that he it was a prominent part of his speech. And Joe Forzano here is going to cue up a clip. This is a little bit of Ron DeSantis talking about his pledge to fight for better water quality.
We will fight toxic blue-green algae. We will fight discharges from Lake Okeechobee. We will fight red tide. We will fight for our fishermen. We will fight for our beaches. We will fight to restore our Everglades. And we will never, ever quit.
Now, maybe I'm just a history nerd, but to me, when I heard that, it immediately reminded me of another famous speech. Mr. Forzano, cue up that other clip, if you would, please.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Winston Churchill, 1940, with the fight on the beaches speech. I'm assuming
you know, it's kind of a thin line between ripoff and homage. I guess that was an homage to Churchill. I don't know, but it was interesting. And the interesting thing about it, though, is he did talk a lot about environment and water quality issues during the campaign. And now that he's in a position to govern, you know, sometimes there's things you say as a candidate that you kind of conveniently forget or tuck away once you're in office. But he made that a prominent part of his speech. He didn't provide new details in the speech about, you know, what he's going to do, but he's clearly keeping that issue out there as something, and that'll be a test of his administration. Zach Anderson, any other things jump out at you about the inaugural address?
One thing that I thought was interesting, George, was sort of the interplay between how he did try to sort of reach out and be a little bit bipartisan in his rhetoric in the speech, but also really threw some red meat to the Republican base. You know, he opened the speech by quoting Lincoln, who said that there needs to be an open field and a fair chance for one's industry, enterprise, and intelligence. And DeSantis said these principles endure not because they are partisan. They aren't. They endure because they are right. So a little bit of bipartisanship there. And then he closed the speech, as John noted, by saying that we need to overcome the tribalism that has dominated our politics. So some bipartisanship there. But in between, he talked about immigration, cracking down on sanctuary cities. He talked about activist judges. And as John noted in his story about the inauguration, these were some of the biggest applause lines that he got. So, you know, the reality is that DeSantis is very conservative. You know, he was a founding member of the Freedom Caucus in Congress, a close ally of Trump. But in order to be successful, he probably needs to expand beyond that conservative base. And we saw some of that in his speech.
A little bit of both, a little bit of bipartisanship, keeping the base satisfied as well. Yeah, Liz, you mentioned the judicial activism quote. I believe we have a clip of that. Joe Forzano, could you play that one for us, please?
To my fellow Floridians, I say to you, judicial activism ends right here and right now.
And as you can hear, that was one of the big applause lines of the speech coming out swinging against judicial activism. And less than 24 hours later, he began to put that pledge into reality, went down to Miami to the Freedom Tower, which is a very significant kind of it's been called the Ellis Island for Cuban Americans because it's where a lot of Cubans who were fleeing Fidel Castro's regime would come when they came to Miami and to America. So he went to the Freedom Tower and named a Cuban American judge, Barbara Lagoa, as to the Florida Supreme Court. John Kennedy, tell us some about the significance of his first, and he's going to have two other Supreme Court appointments. Put that in some perspective for us, please.
Yeah, this is a big change for Florida government. Lagoa is the first of three picks that DeSantis will make probably this month to replace Justices Barbara Pariente, Peggy Quince, and Fred Lewis, who all hit what had been the age 70 mandatory retirement age. They stepped down when DeSantis took office. The retirement age was up by voters to 75 in November, but that didn't affect these three departures. Lagoa has been on the 3rd District Court of Appeals since 2006. She was appointed by Jeb Bush, and she's a conservative Cuban-American judge who will now be the second Hispanic justice and could be the only woman on the court. Pariente, Quince, and Lewis, they're the last picks of a Democratic governor, the late Lawton Chiles. And they pretty much have combined to become a block that stymied a lot of Republican governors and the Republican-controlled legislature on cases involving abortion, redistricting, school vouchers, healthcare, and a lot of different business issues. You heard DeSantis's view of the court, you know, seeing too many judges as judicial activists and eager to, as he described it, quote, legislate from the bench. Of course, you know, defenders of the Florida Supreme Court saw these retired justices as just protecting the Constitution, basically shielding Floridians from what they saw as the excesses of the majority party. But by the time DeSantis's appointments are made, you know, this court is going to look a lot different. For one, it will have no black member for the first time in 36 years since the nominations that are now before DeSantis. The remaining openings have no black nominee. 9 of the 11 lawyers and judges that were nominated by the Judicial Nominating Commission are members of the Federalist Society. This is a conservative legal organization that vows not to overreach when it comes to legislative matters. So it's very likely that DeSantis and the Republican legislature will have a pretty easy go of it with the new court when it comes to enacting new policies. So I'm thinking, watch for some eye-catching legislation to get advanced, that maybe the legislature was reluctant to do before, like allowing the school tax dollars to follow the child. This was a early goal of Governor Jeb Bush, and this could become, basically a major expansion of the state's private school voucher program. Now, that's a maybe, this is something that once that new court is seated, I think the Republicans are going to feel a little bit, unchained.
Yeah. A reminder that elections have consequences. And so with these three picks, DeSantis, even if he serves 2 full terms, 8 years, the Supreme Court appointments will he'll be leaving his mark on Florida long beyond that. And another development this week that will have far-reaching implications is in November, voters approved by nearly a 2-to-1 margin Amendment 4, which restores voting rights to most felons who have completed their sentence, other than murderers and sex offenders. More than 1 million people became eligible to register and vote on Tuesday. And Lulu Ramadan is joining us as our special guest to talk a little bit about that. She did some firsthand reporting on it. So as is our custom, we always welcome our guests with that special royalty-free surf music. Lulu and Zach Anderson, we're going to hear from as well, because he did some reporting this week on it. But Lulu's done a lot of reporting about the explain briefly what the old system was. If you were a felon who had completed your sentence, what happened before you could vote?
Yeah, absolutely, George. So this definitely marks a really big change and a really, the potential for huge political implications in Florida. So before Amendment 4 passed and then took effect Tuesday, the system was one where felons had to file an application and go through really an onerous background check process, and often had to travel to Tallahassee and appear before the governor and cabinet to have their rights restored. And it was an arbitrary and sometimes embarrassing process. I was, emotional for a lot of the folks who had to go up there and do this. And it was one that was very restrictive, because the Palm Beach Post reported before the November election that Governor Scott restored rights to the fewest people since any of his, the fewest felons since than any of his predecessors in the past 50 years, and the lowest percentage of black men, blacks, and Democrats than any of his predecessors in the past 50 years. So you can tell just by being able to analyze the percentage breakdown of who has their rights restored that it comes down to a really arbitrary process where it's left in the hands of one person.
I urge anyone to Google some of those stories that ran in the Palm Beach Post by Lulu Ramadan and who else was on those? Wayne Washington,
yeah.
And the stories that ran that really detailed how the process, the old process worked. So now voters, I think 64 or 65% of voters approved this amendment, which basically automatically restores rights to these folks. And so both Lulu over here on in South Florida and Zach over in the Sarasota area were out there doing some firsthand reporting. Let me start with you, Lulu. Tell me a little bit about what you saw on Tuesday.
Yeah, so it was a really interesting sight on Tuesday. Of course, we knew that this would be a big push, because there are now about 1.2 million more eligible voters in Florida. And in a state that's got, notoriously close electoral margins, it means a lot. But people were a couple folks were lined up outside elections offices in Palm Beach County, which happens to be the hub of public corruption. where a lot of elected officials went down for crimes, you know, back in the 90s and the early 2000s. Those officials actually turned out. A few of them came and registered to vote, including one particularly powerful person in her heyday, former Palm Beach County Commissioner Mary McCarty. And she was first in line in one of the elections offices. And, you know, she served time for public corruption.
Yeah. At one point, four of the seven members of the Palm Beach County Commission went to jail. Mary McCarty was one of them. Three of them went to, I guess four of them were convicted. Three of them went to federal prison. And then Jeff Koons, a Democrat, was convicted in state court, but did not serve
That's
time.
Right.
But you had four felons. And so Mary McCarty was first in line.
That's right. And Mary McCarty is a Republican. And I found it very interesting. There's this big argument kind of taking place. You know, the move to restore voting rights to felons became a highly politicized one, sort of behind the scenes, because of the implications, because studies have showed and experts have said that felons are more likely to identify as Democrats. But interestingly enough, there were a lot of Republicans that turned out in Palm Beach County who I spoke with and who registered and who were politically involved, just like McCarty, but maybe in different capacities before, but maybe not so much.
And, you know, well, I'll tell you, during the campaign before Amendment 4 passed, Jeremy Ring, Democrat who was running for CFO, one of the standard lines he would have in his campaign speeches was that, you know, if he got elected and Democrats were on the cabinet, they would be the clemency board and they would automatically restore rights. And Jeremy Ring, you know, in the simplified version on the campaign trail, at least said, you know, these people will basically all be Democrats and we're going to unelect Donald Trump in 2020. So, yeah, there's definitely partisan overtones to it, although, you know, it passed with 64%. So there had to be a lot of Republicans in support of that as well. Well, Zach Anderson, you on the first day that people could register, you were over there witnessing that. Tell us a little bit about what you saw.
So there was about two dozen people who held a press conference outside the Sarasota County Supervisor of Elections beforehand. And it was a lot of the people that helped to pass the constitutional amendment. It was a pretty joyous occasion. People were singing, people were applauding, chanting, and a number of them then went inside and registered to vote. We have a clip from the press conference with one of the former ex-felons, Wesley Tunstall, who was a Sarasota pastor who had his rights restored this week.
When I awakened this morning, the old song fell on my mind. Said, "Little baby boy, sing, sing, till up in heaven, ring, ring with the liberty of liberty." I don't know all the verse of it, but the meaning of it. It fell in my heart and I hadn't had time to practice it, but I want you to know the meaning of it, that we have liberty once again. We have the right to be called part of the community, to be part of registered voters of the United States. And so we're grateful for that. To God be the glory.
Wow. Tell us about that atmosphere, Zach.
Yeah, that song that Pastor Tunstall sang is called "Lift Every Voice and Sing." And it is a song that was sung a lot during the civil rights movement. It's a song that is sometimes referred to as the Black National Anthem. And it just goes to show that there's a huge civil rights overtone to this felons voting rights movement. A lot of people looked at this law, the clemency process that was set up in Florida, as something that was explicitly set up to keep Black people from voting in the state. It was set up in the late 1800s, I think shortly after Florida became a state and adopted its first constitution. It's part of the sort of Jim Crow era of laws. And as Lulu's reporting showed, a few Black people were actually getting their rights restored through this. So it took on big civil rights overtones. Pastor Tunstall is African-American. There was a lot of other African-Americans who were involved in the press conference outside the Sarasota Supervisor of Elections, including Demetrius Jafunza, who is the vice chair of the Sarasota NAACP and was very involved in this voting rights movement. So you know, it definitely feels like to a lot of people that this is beyond just, you know, restoring people's voting rights, that this is really an important moment for African Americans and for civil rights. Florida, you know, there was just a huge number of people who were denied the right to vote in the state. Florida was one of just a few states where you didn't automatically get your voting rights restored after you had served your time, that you had to go through this clemency process that was very opaque and onerous. And again, like I said, a lot of people viewed it as a legacy of the Jim Crow era. So there was it definitely felt like a very joyous occasion, especially for some of the African-American folks who viewed this as a continuation of the civil rights movement.
Definitely. Lulu, any other impressions you had?
No, I completely agree. I think across the board, it's clear that it happened across Florida, that political implications aside, on an individual level, this meant a lot to a lot of people. We heard a lot of phrases like, I finally am a citizen again, and I felt like I was nobody, and now I'm somebody. And to have to ask for your rights back from a man, you know, the governor, who you weren't able to elect into office, you weren't able to vote for or against, it was hard for a lot of people. And so this is a big moment for a lot of, for more than a million people in Florida.
Indeed. And as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, it's never too soon to talk about 2020, when a lot of this, these new people will have the first opportunity to vote. And there's literally dozens of Democrats who are thinking about running for president. And but the biggest name in the bunch is former Vice President Joe Biden. And he is expected to make an announcement soon about whether he's going to run in 2020. Well, I was able to talk. There's always a Florida connection to everything. And Joe Biden's youngest brother, Frank Biden, lives in Palm Beach County. And I sat down and talked with him recently. And first, here is Frank Biden's take on whether his brother will run.
Yeah. You can say that Frank thinks his brother's going to run. Now, he could surprise me.
Yeah.
But I know the family's behind him 100%.
So Frank is all in. He's expecting his brother to run. And you know, if Joe Biden runs, here is Frank Biden's take on what kind of appeal Joe Biden would have.
Who do you think the disaffected Republicans and the disaffected Democrats that we need to win over, to win Pennsylvania, to win Michigan, to win Wisconsin, to win Ohio, to win Florida, as a strictly Machiavellian question?
Yeah.
Who is best positioned to win those votes back?
Now, you know, the argument that Joe Biden would be the have this kind of lunch bucket appeal to these disaffected voters is certainly been out there a lot. Although, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he does run, because the a lot of younger and grassroots Democrats appear to be pushing the party more to the left and kind of away from the Joe Biden brand of Democrat. But you know, if he runs, we'll see how that plays out. And the last clip I wanted to play, I asked Frank, you know, Joe Biden flirted with running in 2016, and in the summer of 2015 and fall of 2015, he was given it serious consideration, ultimately, obviously decided not to run. But I asked Frank Biden, if your brother had run in 2016, would things have been different? Here is the answer he gave me.
We never would have lost Scranton, Pennsylvania, and all my relatives who voted for the Finnegan family, who voted for Donald Trump, because they felt slighted by Hillary and her campaign. We never would have not gone to Michigan, as the campaign decided not to do, because they felt entitled to the votes of those people.
Mm-hmm.
The assumptive politics is losing politics.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work for every single vote. People have to know individually, collectively, and separately, that you care about them.
Yeah.
That they're important. The idea of declaring the whole, a whole swath of people deplorables is just the most idiotic political calculation, number one, and two, the most, you know, in the Catholic Church, they would call that the sin of pride.
So Frank Biden, pretty blistering critique of Hillary Clinton's campaign. We recorded that in a coffee shop. I don't know. I don't know what that pounding noise was. We weren't in some kind of industrial plant. That was a coffee shop in Delray Beach. Just real quickly, each of the other podcasters here, what's your gut feeling on whether Joe Biden's going to run? Lulu, what do you think?
I think you had the scoop before anyone. It sounds like if you were going to do it, aside from talking to your consultants and closest political allies, you'd probably tell your family first. So let them be a little prepared for some public scrutiny. So
there you go. Like Zach, and what's your guess?
One point, I mean, he's saying that Joe Biden won't neglect Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan. I don't think any Democrats are going to be neglecting those states. This time around, I think, you would hope if you're a Democrat that the party learned its lesson and that they will be campaigning aggressively up there. Whether or not Joe Biden has more appeal in those areas is arguable. But he certainly does seem to have that sort of blue collar appeal that could be helpful in some of those places that have a big industrial base and a lot of blue collar voters.
Yeah, it'll be remarkable. I mean, I would fully expect Biden to be one of the many Democrats running. Biden's going to be 78 years old, though, during that race. That's going to be, you know, a pretty different demographic that he presents compared to what seems to be the strength of the Democratic Party, which is a lot of younger voters. So, he's going to make Bernie Sanders look like a youngster maybe when he's in there. Certainly he's younger than Hillary. Biden will be older than Hillary Clinton was when she ran against Trump, and he'll be older than Trump for that election. So that's going to be an interesting combination there.
It'll be a generation rumble in if Biden gets in. All right. Well, I think speaking of rumble, I think I hear some kind of funky royalty free music playing again. There it is. All right. Well, that means it's time to return to that pick a number segment. I know everyone's been anticipating that. Let's see. We started out Lulu Ramadan, our very special guest, had the number 36.5. Could you explain what that number means?
Yeah, absolutely. So it looks like I'm staying right on subject, because 36.5 is the percent turnout for voters 29 and younger in Florida in the general election, in the midterm. So that's the lowest of any age demographic there. And, come 2020, like you said, it seems like the Democratic Party is starting to move a little more left, and they're going to try to appeal to young progressives. And Florida, clearly, despite the fact that Parkland happened here and we had a really big movement among young voters, it doesn't seem like the best place to appeal to youngsters, because they are generally unreliable. So we'll see if Florida becomes a battleground for that.
Very strong take. All right. Zach Anderson, 84.
Yeah, George, that's the number of appointments that Rick Scott made to various state boards and agencies in just the last week when he was a lame duck governor on his way to the Senate. He made all these appointments, really kind of upset the DeSantis camp, that they kind of viewed that as their prerogative as the incoming administration to make those appointments. And it seems to have created quite a bit of tension between Scott and DeSantis. And some people are speculating that this is sort of a power move by Scott, and that both of them might want to run for president at some point. And they're kind of jockeying to see who's going to be the alpha dog Republican in the state. DeSantis has come out and said that he's going to rescind some of those appointments. So we'll have to see what happens with that. One of the appointments was a gentleman, Carlos Baruff, from over in this area, who's a prominent home builder and has been a close ally of Rick Scott, served as the chair of the Constitutional Revision Commission and on a bunch of other state boards, and has given a ton of money to Scott's campaigns. Baruff was appointed to serve on the Fish and Wildlife Commission, even though as a developer, he's been blasted by environmental groups for his environmental record, and people have accused his developments of being not being environmentally sensitive. DeSantis trying to position himself as the environmental governor, that could be an appointment that he looks at if folks don't think that Baruff has the environmental credentials to hold the job.
All right. Another very interesting number, 84. So we'll see whether Ron DeSantis whittles that number down from the 84 that Scott appointed. John Kennedy, 18.4.
Yeah, that's as in $1 billion that is needed to in upgrades to Florida's wastewater systems. We're talking about the environment earlier today and how DeSantis has that as a priority. But according to the American Society of Civil Engineers in its 2016 report, Florida wastewater systems need $18.4 billion, roughly 20% of the state's overall budget, in fixes. That number was floated, I guess that's a good term, this week by a researcher from Florida Atlantic University to a Senate committee. This researcher, Brian LaPointe, he's backed by the Florida Chamber of Commerce, which is emerging as a champion of the sugar industry's view that leaking septic tanks are the cause of the red tide and blue-green algae that has harmed both coasts. Now, you know, the sugar and the farm industry are mostly getting a free pass in LaPointe's research. LaPointe says the state needs to do something to finance something that's he likened to the Manhattan Project, you know, that created the atom bomb. He needs that kind of focus on the septic systems around the state. But now I think going forward, you know, DeSantis is committed to doing something about this water issue. But I think a fight in the legislature looks likely to become, you know, how much the agriculture industry should pay and how much taxpayers should foot the bill for cleaning up these waterways.
Definitely something to watch in the months ahead on the environmental front. My number was 432. That's the number of days from today's podcast until Florida's 2020 presidential primary. It seems like a long time, but it's likely in 2019. Very soon, we're going to start seeing some of these Democrats who are thinking about running in 2020. And Florida's primary comes kind of in the middle of the pack after several other primaries. So who knows by the time the primary rolls around, how many candidates will still be in the race. But I would expect candidates to be here, if not to connect with voters, also to raise money. Florida is always an important fundraising state. So politics watchers, you should be seeing a lot of the 2020 field here in Florida in the year ahead. Well, that wraps up another one of our podcasts. It's my honor to be your host. I'm George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post. I've been joined here by my colleague, Palm Beach Post staff writer Lulu Ramadan, and I've been assisted here in West Palm Beach by Joe Forzano. We've also had the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy in Tallahassee, and Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson. And as always, the digital audio director in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the man that makes it all happen, Adam Fish. Thank you.